last month to some ballyhoo, President Vladimir Putin of Russia unveiled two nuclear-powered and nuclear-tipped missiles. One, a subsurface missile, a so-called underwater drone, and another one, the Burevestnik, that's able to fly what they say is an unlimited range. It has a nuclear propulsion for both the Poseidon under the water and the Burevestnik in the air. And the claim is that there's nothing that can stop either one of them. Now, there have been many in the West that have said, yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. And in fact, some people have said that the Burevestnik itself is not even a real missile, not what's claimed anyway, though there are pretty much wide agreement that the Poseidon is a real issue that we need to be concerned about. But we have been inundated with requests on our channel to have MIT Professor Ted Postol come on to give us the no kidding deal, because he has been literally our go-to source on this. And really, and most people, anyone who's looking for the actual story anywhere on the internet, it's going to be you, especially with what you did with the Israeli and the Iranian missiles, where you were spot on about what would happen to that before it did. So everybody's really wanting to know what you have to say about this. So welcome back to the show. Eager to hear you.
Well, I have an undeserved reputation and I have to try to keep it.
That's how it always works, man. You step it up there to like Tom Brady, man. You got to bring it every time. So we're looking
right.
Anyway. Well, listen, let's get right into this. First of all, I mean, let me just kind of to remind folks, just kind of set the stage here. This is in late October. Vladimir Putin made a big deal of having a conversation with his chief of general staff, Gerasimov, talking about the Burevestnik.
I am talking about the test of the Burevestnik cruise missile with a nuclear power plant that no one else in the world has. Comrade Supreme Commander, such a test was conducted on October 21st. That a multi-hour flight of this rocket was carried out, which it covered a distance of 14,000 kilometers. And this is not the limit. With a nuclear engine? Yes, with a nuclear engine. And the tactical and technical characteristics of the Burevestnik missile generally allow it to be used with guaranteed accuracy against highly protected objects at any distance. And thus its high capabilities for bypassing missile and air defense systems were demonstrated.
So those are some pretty big boasts, a limitless range, and nothing that can knock it down. What do you say?
Well, it is a missile with, for all practical purposes, of limitless range. The test that Gerasimov and Putin were talking about ran for about 15 hours. So it traveled about 14,000 kilometers in 15 hours. That turns out to be a significant piece of information, because it means that the Burevestnik cruise missile has a speed of about Mach 0.85 or Mach 0.9. So we know the speed of it, and that gives us an estimate of the thrust of the missile, which in turn gives us an estimate of the power of the nuclear reactor that's propelling the Burevestnik. So we have a lot of insights that come from those simple statements in the discussion between Putin and Gerasimov. And what I'll do is explain what this missile looks like as best we can tell. There are clearly uncertainties in what I know. I'll try to be very clear where there are uncertainties. But we do know enough about it to know that this is going to be an unstoppable threat. It can not only come from any direction, it can come at any time. You could have this missile loitering even over your own territory without you knowing about it, and then have it, you know, then make the last dash to the target, and from any direction it chooses. And missile defenses are, they tend to be limited in the azimuth they can cover. Certainly the Patriots have this problem.
And I want to look at several specific things here, and some of the claims that have been made. I wonder if you could tell us what's true and what's not. But let's look first of all about the engine itself, because there are some claims that, you know, this came out of nowhere. But other people have said, no, they've been talking about this, and there's this technology has existed for a long time, but it hasn't been able to be miniaturized to where it can function inside of a missile. Can you tell us a little bit about what you know about the origins of this technology?
Well, both the United States and the Soviet Union had nuclear-powered missiles and aircraft under development in the 1950s and actually 1960s. So it's quite a long time ago. It's 60 years ago. But the technology was demonstrated at various levels, both in the U.S. and Russia. Now, part of the reason it was abandoned was because these long range, in this case, they were going to be supersonic or hypersonic nuclear powered missiles, powered by very large nuclear reactors, nuclear reactors that would generate maybe 400 or 500 megawatts of power. The
Ted, can I ask you to maybe take your headphones off because your audio is kind of coming in and out. Maybe just disconnect them and just go straight with your audio on your computer. Okay, unfortunately now I can't hear anything. Gary, can you suggest anything here?
He actually might have to go out completely and then come back into the studio.
Okay,
to re-engage.
Yeah, Ted, if you can go ahead and do that.
Yeah, Ted, go out of the studio and then come back in.
Meanwhile, while he's doing that, Gary, if you can put that full screen up, we have some breaking news, actually. We got right before we came on the screen here. The UK has suspended its intelligence sharing with the U.S. over these boat strikes in the Caribbean Sea in a major break from the United States. But one of the reasons that they're claiming that they're doing this is because they are not convinced of the legitimacy of the intelligence. They are not convinced of the legality of the actions that we were taking. And this is something we've been talking about literally since the first strike, is that the intelligence, it seems very spotty. We've never been able to see any of it. We've just been told to trust the government. And yet there's now, I think as of today, 76 people have been killed, and they're now actually starting to expand some of the scope of where these strikes are going. And this is a real big problem. And listen, this is one of the things that why I've been warning about some of this, because it damages our reputation and our credibility. When we are no longer a nation governed by the rule of law, and we are running fast and loose with the rules just because we want to and we think we can, when you have finally even our literally closest ally, there is nobody closer of an ally to the United States than the UK is, and when they're making this really public break with the United States, and according to what is breaking on CNN, this actually happened about a month ago, so they didn't waste any time at all, but it wasn't made public. They were at least saying, all right, we'll just, you know, keep this on the down low, but they're not going to participate. Well, now it's come out, so it's a really kind of a big issue and an embarrassment and something we need to pay a lot more attention to. Okay, so I see we're still, Ted is in the process of getting reconnected here. We'll have Ted go right back with us here in a second. But let's don't minimize this issue here. Just imagine UK, who's often been derided as being a poodle of the United States and a lapdog and just somebody who does whatever they're told. And certainly that's been the case with many things over the years, but not the least of which was in the Middle East with Israel and with the Ukraine situation, with the war. They have done basically dutiful actions. Pretty much everything that we've asked them to do, they've done. They've supported us diplomatically, economically, militarily, you name it. I've done lots of joint operations with the British soldiers my entire career while I was on active duty. Everything from Desert Storm all the way up through all sorts of other things in the Middle East, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now then, for them to come out and this to be one step too far for them, that really tells you something, because the British have not exactly been known as the Sunday school group that is worried about things being moral or immoral. But then when they've done this, that really tells us something. And I really hope that this gets our attention and that we get this problem fixed. We'll get you more to that as we get details. So far, it's just now breaking news. And now back to Ted Postlewood. We got you with you?
I hope so.
That sounds good. Yeah, we are okay. Definitely good to go. So I think when we kind of lost you there, you were telling us about the ability of the engine to be miniaturized and how this had been something that both the Soviets and the U.S. had been doing previously. Take it from there.
Right. And basically, there was an interest. If you keep in mind, in the 1950s and even early 60s, neither the United States or Soviet Union were sure that either side could build ICBMs to deliver nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, first of all, were very heavy if you wanted significant yields. And the accuracies of the ballistic missiles were measured in miles. Typically 5 or 6 miles was sort of a very accurate missile at the time. So if you had 10 or 15 kiloton nuclear warhead and you could only deliver it with a 4 or 5 mile accuracy, it was questionable whether you could even hit some cities. And so in the early days, in the 50s and ultimately in the early 60s, there were tremendous advances in inertial guidance systems and on both sides. And then it became clear that you could build large enough ICBMs that could carry the weight of some of these large warheads. I mean, the Titan warhead, for example, was carried by the Titan missile. Once we and the Soviets demonstrated rather than speculated that we could build ICBMs, then the need for a supersonic or hypersonic nuclear powered missile was really questionable. And it had all these problems, like the radiation from these. You don't shield the reactors on these missiles because the shielding weighs so much that you just basically build an unshielded reactor and it's emitting tremendous amounts of radiation into the environment, which is a problem. And of course, keeping the electronics in these missiles functioning in the extreme radiation environments that were created by the nuclear propulsion system was a demanding task.
And in fact, that's one of the reasons why a lot of people suspected that this was not true, because they say that a lot of the tracking devices from the Western world that were near the flight path said they did not detect any radiation, and therefore they calculated, well, then there must not have been a nuclear-powered engine. What do you say?
Well, I mean, the reactor is an extremely intense source of gamma rays and neutrons, neutrons being the dominant dose factor if you're a human near the reactor, it's the ranges at which this reactor could be detected at best could be measured in kilometers with an appropriate radiation detection device, and because it's a radiation source, but it's not necessarily emitting large amounts of radioactive material. In other words, one of the problems associated with a nuclear propulsion system of this type is the air that passes through the reactor, because it's heating air directly, is irradiated. And so you do get radioactive air coming out, but the decay times for the radioactive air are relatively short. And although it's intense, if you were, breathing the air, near the reactor, it doesn't propagate very far because it's not persistent. So the only persistent source of radiation that you could potentially get from one of these reactor exhausts is if there was a lot of dust sucked up by the engine from the air, and this dust is particles that get radioactive as they're sucked through the reactor, and that they persist. But that's not a big source of radiation relative to real radioactive particles from the reactor itself. So it's no surprise at all that they're not detecting any radiation from this reactor.
So what do you think changed? Because you were describing in the earlier phases of this technology development that there was all kinds of problems with the shielding and the radiation on the electronics, et cetera. But now then apparently they overcame that.
Well, first of all, the reactors that the Russians are using are 100 times less powerful than the reactors that people were using for the much faster supersonic or hypersonic variants of these missiles. In addition, the reactors that were being tested at the time were on the ground. You know, they have a test reactor; it's not flying in a device. And this stuff is sucking up dust from the ground. I mean, you know, you can't do a test of a 400 megawatt reactor that's sucking in hundreds of kilograms per second of air, where you don't sucking in a lot of dust, and that dust gets irradiated. And you know, you didn't want to be in those areas, you know, behind the reactor
when it
was operating or afterwards. But if it were in the air at a high altitude, which is what they were planned to do, it would be, you wouldn't want to be in the path, but the path relative to the overall volume of air that it's functioning in would be, would not be enormous. And unless you were unlucky enough to be literally in the path of the reactor and stayed in it.
Got it. Okay. I wonder if you can move on to the claim of it being indefensible. That Vladimir Putin said that no matter what, nobody has any defenses against it. We do have some defense against some cruise missiles. So some people argue that that's just an empty claim, that maybe it's hard, but it's not impossible. What does your research tell you?
Well, I think the shape of the nose, which we can see, I'll show you some images of the nose, is certainly it's designed, the shape characteristics tells you immediately that the radar reflectivity from the nose of the missile, which should be the dominant contributor to the radar reflection. You got it there. And that nose, actually, if you go to slide 11, I think it's slide 11, there you go, and then slide 12, if I got it right. I screwed up. I sent you. All right, it's okay. Slide 11 is good enough. If you see the shape of that nose and you look at it up close, which we can see in slide 10, okay. All those surfaces are rounded. They're not sharp. And not only are they rounded, but I can guarantee you that there's radar-absorbing material behind the surface that you see. So there's some kind of light paint on it, which may have radar-absorbing materials within it. And then there's almost certainly radar-absorbing material behind it. So the radar reflection from the nose, which is what you're going to see when it's coming at the radar system, is the air defense system, it's going to be very, very small. Wouldn't surprise me if it's below a hundredth of a square meter. So it's also going to be coming in low, so there's going to be ground clutter. And these radars are not going to see it. They're just not going to be between the ground clutter masking the incoming missile and the extremely low radar reflectivity of the missile itself. They're just simply not going to see this thing coming.
I wonder if you can just briefly explain to us how the standard, I understand that there's limitations on our ability to intercept things under any circumstances, but let's just say in the best case scenario, if we have some advance warning of where a threat may come from, you say there's some issues about orientation. I don't know if that's of the attack.
Patriot radar.
So tell us a little bit about what a best case scenario looks like and what this can do to a best case scenario.
Well, the Patriot radar has about 120 degrees of azimuth look. So if you want to search for 360 degrees azimuth, you need three of these radars, you know, set up looking in three.
Per battery or per defended site.
Per defended site. Each battery has one of these. So you'd have, we have the radar is a real bargain at $200 million. You know, you have a limited number of them. We do have up to 40 Patriot radars, they're going to be only, you know, let's say 10 or 15 sites you can hope to protect at this level.
Well, let's just pick one. Let's say New York City was a priority target for the bad guys and a priority defended target for us. And so we used multiple radars to get a 360 degree. How is that going to work against this missile?
Well, it probably would not be seen by the radar itself because the clutter. If you're talking about a city, for example, you get reflections off the faces of the buildings. You start looking close to the horizon. Now, what happens when you're looking close to the horizon, your beam is not, it's not a beam like a flashlight beam. There's a lot of spillover. So if you have a little, if the beam is not perfectly focused, which you don't have with a radar beam, it's distributed, then even a small spillover at the edge of the beam that is reflects against the ground and the corners of structures on the ground gives you a tremendous background reflection. So this is called clutter. Now the clutter is enormous, can be millions of times larger than the actual reflection from the missile that's coming in. Now, in order to separate the signal from the clutter, you do what's called, you look for a slight frequency shift in the radar cross-section of the incoming missile. You try to use this frequency shift to separate it out, but there's only so much you can do. And when you look at the clutter rejection capabilities of the Patriot missile system, it's not up to the job. For example, we know that the Patriot missile systems in Iran did not even see in Syria. In Saudi Arabia, did not even see the incoming Iranian cruise missiles that destroyed all of these facilities in the
oil infrastructure,
oil production facility. They just didn't even see them. Now, this cruise missile is going to be much lower radar cross section than even the cross sections of the cruise missiles that the Iranians used. So it's just not up to the job. It's just a matter of quantitative capabilities.
Now, that's what we have right now. Now, according to the now Secretary of War back in May, we're about to get a foolproof method that will keep us safe for everything.
This right here, the Golden Dome for America, is game changer. It's a generational investment in the security of America and Americans. Mr. President, you said we're going to secure our southern border and get 100% operational control after the previous administration allowed an invasion of people into our country. President Reagan, 40 years ago, cast the vision for it. The technology wasn't there. Now it is, and you're following through to say, we will protect the homeland from cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, hypersonic missiles, drones, whether they're conventional or nuclear.
Wow. So there you see, we don't have anything to worry. As soon as we get that Golden Dome operational, bam, Budapest, no longer a problem.
Well, or, you know, when I see this, I wish we still had John Cleves and the you know, the British humor on these things, because
maybe a little laughing soundtrack underneath might have helped.
We still need Monty Python, because this would be a perfect, I think of the Monty Python parrot skit. This would be a good variation of the Monty Python parrot skit. I mean, it's just the joke. I mean, this guy, if he knows, if he thinks he knows what he's talking about, he's a total fool.
The Ministry of Silly Walks was always one of my favorite, but I digress. The Ministry of Silly Walks was one of my favorite ones, but I digress anyway. So
yeah, but
back to the equally strange situation with our Golden Dome.
It's just so ridiculous, it doesn't merit even a discussion. I mean, there's no systems. If you look at the systems they're proposing, even, what are they proposing? The system in space has nothing to do with cruise missiles. You can't intercept cruise missiles from space. You can't find them from space. So how are you going to intercept them? And the interceptors you have can barely do ballistic missiles, ICBMs. In fact, it's not even clear they can do that.
Where
are they going to get the drone?
I wonder if I could just kind of break in and get you to talk about something we had talked about a little bit off the air before we got on the here, which I think is really important. There is a recent movie, very realistic, about what might happen with the decision-making process should we receive an incoming ICBM nuclear missile aimed at the United States. And it was called The House of Dynamite, I believe it was. And in there was this section where they fired some ground-based interceptors. They call them GBIs. And when this missile was coming up, they said, all right, we have, as they later explained, a 61% chance. As a coin flip, they were like astounded, the Secretary of Defense, that he said, you mean we're reduced to a coin flip to stop this? But when you saw that, you said you had a different reaction.
Oh, my reaction was the overwhelming probability of intercept is zero. And I can show this. In fact, if you guys are foolish enough to have me on again, I'll give you a briefing.
We will be.
I'll give you a briefing where because I have analyzed these tests in the past over the time that these tests were being made. And the trick that they were, the 61% number comes from a trick. Every time they have a failed test where the orchestrated piece of the test was not as planned. So these are all orchestrated tests. They don't count it as a test. So 61% of the time, actually it's probably closer to 50% of the time, where the test went as it was planned to be orchestrated, they hit the target. In the case where the tests did not go as orchestrated, as planned, it catastrophically failed, and they counted as a no test. But the failures indicated how vulnerable the system was to the simplest of countermeasures. In other words, something occurred that caused a decoy to be present that they hadn't planned for, you know, a false target, and the test couldn't be run. So, and we know that the decoys are the big problem, the big vulnerability of this system are decoys. So they literally scripted out every test that went not as they planned, where there was something unexpected. And because there was something unexpected, the test totally failed. They couldn't even begin to try to have a test. So,
and as far as you know, what is the doctrine for? We'll just pick Russia. I guess you could pick China too if you happen to know. What is their doctrine in terms of some kind of mix of actual missiles to decoys?
Well, I think you could have easily hundreds of decoys to missiles. No problem at all with the Russians. I would say probably the same with the North Koreans. You know, if you can launch a missile with a nuclear war, if you have the technology to build an ICBM, launch, have a nuclear warhead, launch the nuclear warhead on the ICBM, you certainly have the technology to deploy some balloons that would, you know, we know for a fact would fool the system. They would not be able to tell the difference between a balloon. And for those,
wait, let's go on there, because that is like anyone listening to this, me, going, wait a minute. Our ability to distinguish between a balloon and an incoming ballistic missile, we can't differentiate?
No, because the balloon, you see the balloon at a long range, and all you see is its bright radiating surface. You see the warhead at a long range, all you see is its bright radiating surface. Now, there are tricks you can use to try to distinguish the warhead from the balloon. For example, the warhead may wobble a bit. And if it wobbles a bit, the intensity of the fluctuation that you see may fluctuate a bit. And so you say, well, that's not a balloon because there's a fluctuating signal. Well, if I paint a stripe on the balloon and it's a sphere, I can give it the fluctuating signal. So I can take the warhead and put a balloon around the warhead so it looks brighter than you expect the warhead to look. And then I can have lots of other balloons of different sizes and brightnesses around it. So you have no idea what you're looking at. Everything looks like a potential target. These are simple countermeasures that the Missile Defense Agency was clearly aware of. In fact, they changed. I can discuss this in a follow-on talk. When they discovered this vulnerability, they changed the decoy suite that they were testing against. They had these decoys that they were using that were too credible. So what they did is they changed the decoys to less credible decoys that they would have an easier chance
to
tell the difference. And incidentally, they still couldn't tell the difference. So,
and by the way, do we use the same technology on our opponents? Do we use decoys as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have all kinds of decoys. And I can show you pictures of decoys. I have pictures of decoys. I can show you in this, you know, this talk I'll put together.
Yeah.
It's zero is any informed guess. You would have to say must be zero. Maybe there would be less than 1%, much less than 1% chance you would by accident hit a warhead relative to a decoy, but it would be below, you know, well below 1%. There's no chance.
Well, that is not entirely encouraging. Somewhat less than the perfect shot that the Golden Dome was claimed to have by the Secretary of War. We'll leave that at there, and we'll look forward to your.
The House of Dynamite brought up a question that is really important for people to know about, and that we have the data. We have the data.
Yeah, and we're going to look forward to having that.
I should say, some of it. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. In the remainder of the time that we have here, though, I want to look at the other half of what Vladimir Putin was talking about, and that is the Poseidon, because that has got some pretty scary ramifications as well. What can you tell us about the Poseidon?
Well, the Poseidon is an underwater drone. Look, can we try slide 38? There you go. It's an underwater drone. It's probably not 2 meters in diameter as shown in this diagram, which is copied from a website run by a very knowledgeable guy on underwater systems. But if we look at the next slide, 39, we can see how Putin revealed this this weapon system. This is another Monty Python kind of situation, because supposedly this was revealed in, this is a television, this is a frame caught from a television video over the shoulder of of someone who is presenting these slides to Putin. I think it must have been around 2015 or 2016, so quite a while back. It was still under development. And you can see in the middle there, this underwater drone. We can't see all the detail because the video was not that high resolution. But it was an accident, supposedly, where the television video camera caught this. And of course, the reporter got out of the Kremlin. You know, all this stuff was just happened to be shown. But of course, anyone who has two neurons to rub together understands this was a purposeful example of Putin telling us what to expect. So, you know, 6 or 7 years later or 8 years later, we now see it launched. It takes time to develop these things. On the left front of this underwater drone, which probably displaces somewhere between 20 and 30 tons. So it's not a small vehicle. It's significant.
Yeah, that's about the size of some of the World War II submarines, right?
Yeah, it's a small submarine. Yeah, it's definitely a submarine. It's got a nuclear power plant in it, so it can run for an indefinite period of time underwater. And that forward section has enough volume to carry a 100 megaton nuclear warhead. Now, if you want to get a sense for, let's look at slide 41. It's carried in a submarine. It's an Oscar, converted Oscar class submarine. The Oscar class submarine can carry up to six of these doomsday weapons. Why don't you go to slide 44, Gary? Here you are. And this is a cartoon again that shows the Oscar under the Oscar class submarine. It literally carries a mini sub. It can carry a mini sub. And it can carry up to six of these Poseidon 50 to 100 megaton warhead torpedoes. And they are designed to be able to go into the harbor of a target city and detonate. Now, because the warhead is so enormously large, the warhead will create a thermal flash that can set fires at 30 to 40 miles. So that would be 45 to 60 kilometers from the detonation point in the harbor. So you'd burn an area down of maybe 3,000 square miles or 6,000 square kilometers, and set that an area of that size on fire. Just to get a sense, if you look at slide 46, this is a very distant photograph of the detonation of the Tsar bomb, a 57 kiloton bomb. It could have been 100 megatons, I'm sorry, it was 57 megatons. Notice the cloud stem alone is around 10 kilometers. In,
that's about 6 miles, just the stem. Six miles.
Yeah, and you can see the pedestal goes out to 30 kilometers. And if you want to get a sense of what this looks like, we can go back to, I'm just trying to, let's just go to the next slide, slide 47. I've shown you the fireball. This is Hawaii, for those of you who don't know it, so it's Honolulu. So this is a legitimate target. And the inner diameter shows you the area subjected to at least 5 pounds per square inch out to a distance of 13 or 14 miles of blast overpressure. But that's really not the real killer. The outer yellow filled circle shows you the area set on fire by the thermal effects of the fireball. So it shows you the whole, everything in the island would be on fire. So if we go to the next slide, just to give you a sense, you have this 15-mile circle I showed there. If you had a house built like the house shown in this, this is a Nevada test structure, maybe a few tenths of a second at the beginning of the detonation, the house would be illuminated. And then within about 4 or 5 seconds, so 4 or 5 seconds, this is a long time, the fireball will grow to its maximum brightness, and it would be more than 200 times brighter than a desert sun at noon for 5 seconds. And you'd see the surface of this, everything would be on fire. So this is what would occur at the far edge of the island, even. In other words, if you were at the far edge.
Now, you talk about it, but this one, sorry. Sorry about that. This one is a an underwater submarine, right?
Yeah, this is the underwater.
Even if it goes off underwater, it can still cause this on the other side of Hawaii.
Absolutely. If it's detonated underwater, its thermal energy is reduced by about 30%. In other words, if it were detonated in the air over the target, it would have about 30% more brightness than it has from underwater, because a lot of the energy gets suppressed by the detonation under the water. So it's still bright enough to set a building on fire at the far edge of the island of Oahu. You know, in other words, the whole island would be in flames. So nothing on the island would survive. So even though it's detonated underwater, and the nuclear, the thermal pulse is suppressed. So if you want to get a sense of what the pedestal looks like, if we go to slide 50, this is just a guesstimate. The island is, if we go back one slide, 49, there's the island. There's the island itself. And then we go back again to 50. You can see that the pedestal basically covers the island, or comes close to covering the island. And, you know, just everything would be on fire. So this is a doomsday weapon. Now, why would you do this? Let's go to slide 55. If you look at slide 55, this shows you what 6 or 7 of these weapons could do to the coastal cities of the United States. The yellow bright circles show you the area that would be set on fire by these weapons. So what Putin is saying to us is that if you try to attack Russia, this is a doomsday weapon we will launch from submarines. They have ordered some 32 of these weapons. They'll be manufacturing up to 32 of these weapons. They'll be in 5 or 6 Oscar-class submarines. And those submarines will be able to launch these drones, which will have limitless range and endurance under the ocean. And they can take their time and get to the target they want to get to, swim into the harbor, and detonate, or detonate outside the harbor, which is enough to destroy the whole system. Now, why would you do this? Well, let's go to slide 3, because this is a very important point. We have a country that is led by people who know nothing. And I want to, there was an extremely interesting seminar at Stanford last week. I have a recording of it. If anybody wants, I can send you the recording of the seminar. 3 of the people in this seminar are distinguished scholars at Stanford. I mean, let me be clear. Stanford gave them this title. I would give them the title of complete ignoramus fools. That's the title I would give them, all right? So we have these 3 people talking about the war in Ukraine. And you can see, anybody who knows anything about the war in Ukraine can see that they know less than nothing. I say less than nothing because they're talking about things that are complete nonsense. This is Stanford University, the Center for International Security and Arms Control. They have called these people distinguished scholars. This is what the Stanford students are exposed to. If there's any Stanford grads listening to this, you should look at this and you should write the provost and say, what kind of nonsense is being taught to undergraduates and graduate students at Stanford? Because this is outrageous. And all of these people had high-level jobs in government and were given positions at Stanford and called, labeled on their backsides, distinguished scholars. When I wouldn't let them run a lemonade stand or go into any class, in a kindergarten class, and talk about what they know about.
And said, so what did they say that this got you so upset?
Well, they were talking about Ukraine winning the Ukraine war. They were talking about how the Russians have got over 1 million casualties in this war. It's hard to believe. How could you be following this war and know anything about the situation with the advantages of, for example, artillery advantages that Russia has relative to Ukraine, and the tactics of using artillery at long range to soften up targets and kill soldiers before you attack a target? How can you come up with these numbers and speak about them with authority? They're just talking with complete confidence. If you didn't know anything and you listen to these people, you would think that this war in Ukraine is still a contested matter. Now, this is a university that's Center for International Security. How can you be so ignorant? One of these people is a guy named Colin Cald. He was third level guy at the Pentagon under Biden. The other person worked for Jens Stoltenberg. That should tell you everything you need. Rose Gottemuller. Third was a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And these are the people who are telling students and graduate students about what is going on in the world. They have no idea. If you talk to them, and I have, about anything that Putin has said, they have no idea. They'll cherry pick statements Putin has made to try to make him look like a maniac. Here's a statement that I thought we should go over with your audience to give you a sense. This is an impromptu statement that Putin made during the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum in June of 2016. He was just sitting there talking to a bunch of journalists. He just somehow he got on the topic of nuclear deterrence. So here's he says, no matter what we said to our American partners.
Now, this is Putin speaking right here.
This is Putin. This is to curb the production of weaponry. They refused to cooperate with us. They rejected our offers and continued to do their own thing. Rose Gottemuller in this particular group of idiots, she was talking about how the Russians constantly refused to cooperate with the Americans. I can tell you because I watched that in detail because I was looking at the U.S. missile defense activities at that time, that it was the United States that rejected every offer that the Russians did. So she distorted this statement into the Russians being uncooperative, but in fact, they were cooperative. Anyway, he goes on to say they rejected everything we had to offer. That's a correct statement he made, not the statement that Rose Gottemuller made. That means we were right when we said they are lying to us. And incidentally, Gottemuller, if anyone wants to talk to Anatoly Antonov, he will happily tell you that Gottemuller lied to him repeatedly about U.S. missile defense activities. Incidentally, her people lied to the South Koreans about the U.S. missile defense activities in South Korea. I was furious about that, and I wrote her a note, which she never responded to. All right, so their reasons were not genuine. In reference to the Iranian nuclear threat, your people, the populations of Western Alliance, do not feel a sense of impending danger. This is what worries me. In other words, you don't feel the danger from Iran, but you're talking about this nuclear system. So a missile defense system is one element of a whole system of offensive military potential. It works as part of a whole that includes offensive missile launchers. One of the defenses blocks, the other launches high-precision weapons. The third blocks a potential nuclear strike, probably nuclear retaliation he's talking about. And the fourth sends out its own nuclear weapons in response. This is all designed to be part of one system. I don't know how this is all going to end. This, again, is still Putin. What I do know is that we will need to defend ourselves, emphasis added. Now, if we take the, Gary, can you take off the deep dive, the logo of deep dive underneath so we can see? Oh, there it is. Now, here's my note on this. The above Putin statement is an accurate description of U.S. damage limitation and warfighting doctrine and the systems the U.S. has built and operated in support of these doctrines. He understands exactly what we are talking about. We are talking about attacking Russian nuclear forces to do damage limitation. And this is why every time you see Putin talking about a Russian nuclear response to a nuclear attack, to a sudden nuclear attack, he always will say, do not have any doubt that we will respond. Even though we know that the world will end, that we will die along with you, we will respond. Because what he's trying to do is say, this underwater drone is my response to your delusion that you can use missile defense and highly accurate weapon systems to disarm Russia. I want to make sure that you understand, even if you're an idiot who knows nothing about missile, who thinks that the missile defense can intercept 61%, which incidentally is just not true. It's zero. But if you were a president, you might actually believe that, because the 61% number comes from a military officer who comes from Strategic Command, who gave them this number because that's the number he believes it would be. He knows nothing. He's some three-star general. He was told this number. He has no idea what he's talking about. He comes up with the number 61%. You know, it's ridiculous. And this is what a president is going to be told. So this is what Putin is worried about. He's worried about the stupidity of the bureaucrats in the system who then advise a president. And the presidents, notoriously, we know from history that presidents almost never know anything about the nuclear systems. I mean, it's such,
yeah, it's such a good situation for the guy who actually has control and command over that button. But listen, we just have to hope that he'll be watching our show today, and any future president will watch a video of your presentation here so that they will understand and will never even get close to using this, or we'll all pay a catastrophic price. But listen, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming on today and providing such precision and clarity over a very complex issue in ways that just any regular person can understand it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we'll talk about the missile defense capabilities.
We will definitely do that. It's 100% want to get that on the calendar and get that done, because that's also really important.
Take care. Understand.
Thank you very much. Thank you guys very much. Let you know that in just about 30 minutes from now, we're going to have an update on the shutdown situation for the U.S. government. Is it really ending the shutdown? Is it really going to happen? There could be a vote tomorrow, but how effective is this going to be? And is it just going to be kicking the can down the road? I think you know where this is going. But tune in and we'll give you all the details in about 30 minutes at 3:30 p.m. today on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.